Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a BYU valedictorian comes out to fellow classmates during his commencement speech. Kennecott, Utah copper retires a coal-fired power plant. And a Utah gun lobbyist surrenders his bump stock. Those and other stories on the show today. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune senior managing editor Matt Canham. And good morning to you, Matt.
Good morning.
Also in studio with us, reporter Jessica Miller. And thanks for being here, Jessica.
Good morning.
And columnist Robert Gerke is also here. Good morning to you, Robert.
Hi, good morning.
And the number to call to join this conversation is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or tweet questions and comments to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Where to begin today? How about with the story of a Utah college student who at his graduation, during a commencement of a valedictory speech, actually, chose that moment to come out as gay to his fellow classmates. And this was news here and around the country, actually. Jessica Miller, can you tell us about this student and this sort of viral moment in Utah?
Yeah, his name is Matt Easton. He was the valedictorian for the College of Family, Home, and Social Sciences at BYU. And so he decided in that moment for his speech at graduation that he wanted to tell the world that he was gay. I think the words he used was that he... Let me look this up.
Sure.
He says, "I stand before my family, friends, and graduating class today to say I'm proud to be a gay son of God." Wow. So that was the moment that kind of went viral.
I'm sure for most of our listeners, this isn't a surprise, but it was surprising for this to happen at BYU because it is owned by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And Jessica, church teachings on homosexuality take a pretty strict line, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So the Latter-day Saints faith teaches that same-sex attraction is not a sin, but acting on it is. And similarly with the honor code at BYU, students who... It's not against the honor code to be gay, but to act on that, to have same-sex, have a relationship with someone of the same sex is a violation of the honor code. So it's an interesting line that these students are walking.
Did the school, did they know that he was going to come out in this, that he was going to say this during his speech?
They did, actually. And when I was talking with him about this on Monday, he kind of said that he wrote this speech and he gave it to BYU almost like thinking there's no way they would approve this. So that would kind of like take care of the situation for him. And then they approved it and he was like, oh man, now I have to actually do it. Like they said it was okay. And now I have to go up and actually give this speech.
Wow. Is there something to be read in that? I mean, the fact that is there something bigger to be read in that the church allowed that to go through, the church, the school, that is, allowed that to go through, which is owned by the church? Maybe that's a question for Robert Gerke, actually.
That is a Robert Gerke question.
Yeah, a columnist can opine here. And, you know, this is part of the context here is that there have been policy reversals, and we can come back to that, Jessica, in a minute. But Robert Gerke, should we read more into that?
I think watching this evolution at BYU over the last several years has been really interesting, and watching how the church and how the school deal with the issues that other schools have already had to deal with. The LDS teachings are that being having same-sex attractions is not a sin, and so, you know, for him to say that he is gay is, I guess, within the confines or within the bounds for the church. And so I think they also recognize that had they, edited or vetoed the speech, they probably would have gotten a backlash. And so, you know, I think I think the significance of it, though, on a larger scale is that, you know, this young man is not alone in being gay at BYU and being a BYU graduate. And I think that's the significance of this statement, is that, you know, he not only weathered the storm, I guess, to say, at BYU, but he thrived, and that he is representative of a good number of people who attended the college and were graduating from the college and were either, you know, in the closet or they were out, but, living their lives.
Another part of the context here, Jessica Miller, is that there have been protests at BYU and related schools over, or satellite schools, I should say, over the school's honor code, which you brought up. sometimes the enforcement, it's basically over the enforcement of the honor code at those schools. And sometimes that enforcement has to do with someone's actions if they are LGBTQ. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So recently, the school's honor code has been criticized for basically how they investigate and punish students, particularly with how they treat LGBTQ students. So we've seen in the last month or so protests at Rexburg, Idaho, and then here in Provo also, of students just saying that they don't want to get rid of the honor code, but the way that it's enforced and how kind of uneven the punishment can be needs to change, and also just the culture of students being encouraged to turn other students in. That's issues like that. They just want that change. They don't want the honor code to go away, but just the way that it's the students are being treated, they'd like a little bit of a softer approach, maybe something that's more about, you know, turning your life around instead of just punishing you and making you leave the college.
You know, and then the other part that I brought up earlier was the fact that, you know, well, Robert brought it up too, that being gay at BYU and the fact that if you are a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there have been some policy decisions that have been seen as detrimental to people who are gay. Maybe you can talk about a recent policy reversal within the faith and how this moment, again, this kind of viral moment plays into that.
Yeah, so the church earlier this month reversed this policy. It was pretty controversial. It deemed same-sex married couples to be apostates and their children were barred from baby blessings, baptisms, things like that. And so with that reversal, some people, especially within the LGBTQ community, kind of looked at that as a signal that the church is, you know, thinking about these issues, taking a softer approach to how they treat gay members in their church.
Okay. A reminder to listeners that you can join us by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255 with your questions and comments. How was this student's I just forgot his name.
His name's Matt.
Yeah. How was his statement received by the graduating students there assembled for the commencement?
Once he said that he was proud to be a gay son of God, I mean, the whole crowd just started cheering. And that was kind of a surprise to him. He didn't know what the reaction would be. He was pretty nervous. He called it one of the most frightening things he thinks he could do, because this was something that he kind of came to terms with at his time at BYU and struggled with a lot. And so making that declaration, he was really nervous about it. And so seeing that response and seeing his fellow students, a group that he thought maybe would be the last group to stand up and support him, do that was really meaningful for him.
Okay. You know, just before we close out the story and move on to other news from this past week, what is Matt Easton, what is he going to do now that he's graduated from BYU? Where is he going?
So he is already like ready to get into the workforce. He's starting a job. He actually started it this week working at a data analytics firm in Salt Lake City. So he's got a job lined up. He said he thinks he's probably going to go back to school to get a graduate degree, maybe his PhD. So he's just starting to live life like most post-grads do.
Okay. Let's move away from the story and turn to some other news from this past week. And Jessica, we'll stick with you for a little while longer. And there's no easy way to transition to this other piece of news. You also reported this past week on the story of the last person in the United States of America to own a bump stock, which is a gun modifying device. And he's here in Utah. Jessica, who is he and why is he the last man with a bump stock? And actually, maybe you should quickly remind us what a bump stock actually is.
Okay, so his name is Clark Apotian. He is a pretty well-known gun lobbyist here in Utah, and he filed a lawsuit. Once the federal government reclassified bump stocks as a machine gun, it's basically a shooting accessory that goes onto a gun that turns it into a sort of machine gun. It was used in the shooting in Las Vegas, and so after that mass shooting, the government decided to reclassify it as a machine gun and banned it. So everyone had until like a March deadline to get rid of their bump stocks, like shred them, melt them, whatever they wanted to do. But Clark decided to file a lawsuit challenging that ban, basically arguing that it was unconstitutional in the way that the government went about making that decision.
Right. His argument was sort of this is top down policy. This isn't because the way that these were banned wasn't Congress making a decision. This was the administration, the Trump administration, essentially.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, he's saying that if they want to make a law banning these bump stocks, Congress should be making that law, but instead they just reclassified their definition of a bump stock and what that was and decided to ban them. So when he filed that lawsuit, in it he filed what's called an injunction. He basically asked them, like, don't have me get rid of my bump stock, because if I win my lawsuit and it's been like melted down or whatever, then I will have irreparable harm because I won't have my bump stock anymore. So that worked for a while. He had it was approved by the 10th Circuit, but then they went back and read over the filings again and the arguments, and they decided that there actually wasn't any real harm. What ended up happening is he has to go turn in his bump stock by Monday, and they'll just hold on to it. So they won't destroy it, but the government will hold on to it until the lawsuit is done.
While the court case plays out.
Exactly.
Columnist Robert Gerke, Clark Apocian's legal challenge over bump stocks. To make a point, I guess, about the process for changing the law, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, his argument and legal argument has some merit to it, frankly. That, you know, this when we start regulating things, for a president to take an executive action like that is, you know, I think whether or not it's legal, I guess, is going to be up to the courts ultimately. And I believe that it's before the appeals court, right? And so, you know, there appears to be some merit to it, but I think the larger issue is that these bump stocks are, you know, not something that even Clark said, I think, that he right. doesn't really like bump stocks. They're not pure shooting. They're just for spraying bullets, randomly, which is why in Las Vegas they were effective. And essentially what they do is they take a semi-automatic gun where you have to pull the trigger each time and make it so you can pull that trigger a lot faster. But it's indiscriminate. And so, you know, there's a widespread public support for getting rid of these. Even the Trump administration felt like it is something that should be done. Clark is a little bit of a hardliner, I guess, on these issues, and isn't going to go quietly. But, you know, it's going to ultimately be for the court to decide.
Again, this shooting that you described, where a bump stock was used in Las Vegas, this was the deadliest mass shooting that we've seen in America. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the public opinion did turn against these things, but he's trying to make a legal point, Jessica.
That's what I've talked to him a lot in the last month or so. I actually went out shooting with him to see what the bump stock kind of how it worked, and his big argument is like he really doesn't like the bump stock that much. I think he called it the lamest shooting accessory that he owns. And when I went out shooting with him, he was like surprised that day that we were there that it actually worked like the way it was supposed to. Like, it's just kind of a weird. He calls it like a good way to like waste a bunch of ammo. Like it's he doesn't love it, but his point is that it's not about the bump stocks are like awesome and they should be kept around. It's that the way that the government went about banning this is unconstitutional, and so his concern is kind of this like slippery slope argument where if they ban bump stocks, who's to say what the next president could ban that he or she doesn't like?
Yeah, I mean, at some point you got to question whether that leads to banning suppressors or, you know, clip size or types of guns with an executive action like this. And so, you know,
That's interesting. I mean, this is sort of specific to American gun culture, right? I mean, there's no sort of argument. The argument or the fear of
the slippery
top down
slope,
regulation
yeah.
isn't extant in other countries or as much in other countries.
Right, and we saw after the shooting in New Zealand that they took quick action to regulate firearms. You know, it's an American, it's a unique American trait, I think.
Jessica, he has till Monday to turn in his bump stock. Is he going willingly? You know,
I asked him. I said, "So are you gonna like go out and take it out one more time?" And he said he wasn't sure yet. He doesn't have any plans, but if the opportunity arises, he might give it one more go.
Okay. On that note, it is time for our first break of the show, and there's still more to come, including a survivor of childhood molestation coming forward to tell his story and the shuttering of the last coal-fired power plant on the Wasatch Front. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, reporter Jessica Miller, and columnist Robert Gerke. Join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can tweet us at KCPW. Matt Canham, Tribune Senior Managing Editor, a power plant in Utah is closing down, or maybe it closed down already, I'm not certain. This is the Kennecott, this is Kennecott Utah Copper's last coal-fired power plant. Why is it shuttering?
Kennecott Utah Copper, the big copper mine, is owned by Rio Tinto, which is its parent company. And Rio Tinto has a goal of making all of its operations carbon neutral by 2050. That's hard when you run a copper mine. So one of the first things they're going to do is change how they get their electricity to run their plant. They used to have four coal-fired power plants. Three of them were pretty outdated, and they shelved them a while ago. This fourth one, they used to run during the summer months. So it wasn't during the high inversion times, but they did run it every summer. The last 2 years, about 2 years ago, they paused on that. And now what they're doing is they're buying renewable energy through Rocky Mountain Power. Rocky Mountain Power runs a wind farm in Wyoming, has other solar operations as well. So they're buying certificates, credits, essentially, to get the right renewable energy for 1.5 million megawatt hours. I don't know what that actually equates to, but it sounds like a lot.
Yeah, it does sound like a lot, definitely. This is also the last coal-fired power plant along the Wasatch Front.
That's correct.
Is this this is difficult to say, but is this going to have an impact, a noticeable change on our airshed here in Salt Lake City?
We talked to some environmentalists, and they said it will. And essentially, not the inversions we think about that happened in January and February, but the high ozone levels that we see during the summer, which still have some negative health effects. Kennecott says this will reduce its carbon footprint by as much as 65%, which is a huge amount for this one company, which is also a major polluter. This is something the governor praised. It's something that Western Resource Advocates, which is a group that we talked to, said will help us reduce those ozone pollutions during the summer. So this is one of those big moments. When you think of our valley here, the Salt Lake Valley, we are essentially ringed by major polluters. They're gravel pits or oil refineries or a big copper mine. To see, one of those big industrial companies take a step like this should benefit everyone who lives in the valley.
Yeah, the CEO of Rio Tinto said that the move will allow the company to offer customers copper, gold, and silver with a reduced carbon footprint. I want to bring Robert Gerke, columnist, in on this. A mining company running its operations on wind and solar, is there something...
This is terrible.
No, is there something? Is there an irony in the fact that you're a mining company and doing this? I mean, I guess obviously you're cleaning up the airship.
I mean, yes. I mean, Rio Tinto's going to still be a polluter, as Matt kind of mentioned. That it's not gonna suddenly stop polluting, but it's gonna be cleaner. And I guess incrementally over time, you get enough companies, enough polluters that are polluting less, and you start seeing some progress. I think, again, sort of taking a step back, this is indicative of a larger trend that we're seeing the big power plants down in central Utah, the coal-fired power plants, sort of projected or scheduled to be phased out as well, or in that somewhere in that process. And you see the companies like Rocky Mountain Power that are trying, slowly over time to move more toward a renewable portfolio. It's inevitable, and I think this is sort of a milestone as we proceed down that road to a cleaner energy profile.
Matt Canham, I just thinking about the mining operations of Kennecott Copper to the west of us here. You might not be the right person to ask this, but they've got a big hole in the ground out there, and they've been digging for a long period of time. Is there much left for them to mine out there? Do you have an answer to that?
I actually have an answer to this.
Okay.
My brother works at Kennecott Copper, so I can answer this question. So when you look at Kennecott Copper now and you see these huge steps in the mountain, They've dug out about as much of that pit as they can. They can go a little bit wider, but not much. So what they're doing now is they're going deeper. Kennecott Copper expects to be operational for decades to come, which is part of the reason you make a step like this, is that this is a long play. One thing I find interesting about this is in that quote that you read from the CEO, it implies that the people who buy Kennecott's copper, gold, silver, or any other metals out of there care about the environment. That it's a marketable thing for Kennecott to announce that they're doing it with less of a carbon footprint. And I think we're seeing that not in only this one corporate entity, but in other corporate entities. You're seeing that in cities who are trying to get Rocky Mountain Power's and renewable energy credits as well, so they could say they're a clean city. And I think that when we look at the air quality problems we have in this state, it is going to be these steps incrementally, one at a time, by a vast group of people, including individuals in their homes, that will get us to where I think everyone wants to go.
It's interesting, the corporate social responsibility sort of aspect of the move.
There's pressure in lots of different areas that way.
Well, you know, the last coal-fired power plant on the Wasatch Front being retired, you can check out the full reporting on this at sltrib.com. A reminder that you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. This is a weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Matt Canham, sticking with you for a tad longer, let's dip into a story about efforts to house homeless people. In particular, a new initiative to get 100 people housed as the closure of Utah's largest homeless shelter is scheduled. Tell us about this initiative.
So this is an idea from the Homeless Resource Center Transition Committee, and transition's the key word there. The state is expected to close the Road Home Shelter that's currently operating downtown. I think they have like 1,100 beds, and they're going to open up three smaller shelters, two in Salt Lake City, one in South Salt Lake City, and they're not going to equate to the same number of beds. So while they might offer more resources to help people who are experiencing particularly temporary homelessness get out of that, there's still that, what do you do? I mean, if you can't close that gap, where are these people supposed to go? Well, what we had is people like the lieutenant governor saying, we don't need to wait until we have that situation to start working on this. And so this group of civic leaders is encouraging landlords to accept housing vouchers from the government to house people who are homeless, currently homeless, before we get to the point where we transition from the one big shelter to three smaller resource centers. That was what the big kickoff was. The state put together some money to help with application fees and deposits and to hire case managers to help be an intermediary between a homeless resident, homeless person who gets one of these housing spots and the landlords if issues come up. And they're trying to drum up attention now to see if they can get some landlords to open up some spots.
There's a quote in the article, or it's not a quote, it's just a piece of the article that reads, with a low vacancy rate across the state, much of the success of vouchers rests in the hands of landlords, some of whom may be hesitant to take on tenants who face mental health challenges or they don't have a clean rental history. The rental market out there also is pretty brutal right now. There's not a lot of available housing. Are landlords going to heed the call here? This is a question for landlords, not for Matt
right.
Canham. But
I think that these civic leaders believe that there is a chance, or they wouldn't be doing this. Also, just shining a spotlight on an issue that isn't going to go away anytime soon, and that is complex enough that three new resource centers isn't going to be enough. In recent weeks, we've seen the housing authorities around the valley here starting new apartment complexes that would be for these people who are transitioning from homelessness, not are out. This next week, the Salt Lake City Council is talking about SROs, single room occupancy buildings, which is something that we as a community has generally moved away from, but it would be like a dorm type scenario for people who are low income or are experiencing homelessness. It's a complex issue. But I also think it's a signal of a concern of what happens when there's less beds.
Yeah, a recognition of the fact that we're going to have fewer beds when the Road Home homeless shelter closes. That's happening in September, I believe. Robert Gerke, you know, this effort is sort of let's kickstart housing before the shelter closes. Soon we're going to have fewer beds, but then there's this new system for tackling homelessness, these homeless resource centers. I guess if the housing isn't there, if affordable housing isn't out there, how do we keep people out of the shelters in the long term?
Well, that's a good question, Roger. And I don't think they know yet because, I mean, the Road Home, these shelters are, you know, last resort. They're emergency housing, and optimally you want to have people in more stable situations because it's hard to find a job when you're working at, when you're living at the shelter. People do it, but it's not ideal. And so the problem is that we live in a city and a county with an acute housing shortage right now, not just for low-income people, but for everybody. And so finding places that are affordable is really, and we've talked about this before on this show, really the biggest challenge of this Operation Rio Grande cleanup that they've embarked on. You know, it's there's not an easy solution to it. And you know, the Section 8 vouchers are a good idea to try to promote those, but those have been around for decades, and you know, the fact that they're not solving the problem probably indicates that it's not it's not going to solve the problem going forward. Plus, you know, we should probably note that the Trump administration, year after year, is proposing billions of dollars in cuts to the Section 8 program. So that makes it harder. Also, these Section 8 vouchers, a lot of times, this is going to get a little nuanced here, but if I'm a developer and I get these Section 8 credits, I can use those to help finance a building project. It turns out if they're looking at cutting those, you can't use those as financing tools instruments anymore, and so that makes the development of these low income complexes a lot more difficult. And so yeah.
Is that because investors or developers are worried that it'll go away, and so they don't want it, or they're not gonna try and use it?
Yeah, they're unreliable, I guess. Let's put it that way. And so it's created a real problem. And so yes, the fact that they're looking at tackling this problem before the shelter closes and it becomes urgent, I think is good. I'm not sure that it's going to be enough in the grander scheme of things, because we have such an acute need and there's just so few options.
It seems like there's a PR aspect of this too, that Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox is trying to convince landlords to step up and say, be counted as somebody who's doing good. But in the end, this is about landlords making a choice to house someone who is homeless or to rent to them with these vouchers. And there's not a big incentive for them to do that.
Well, I mean, the incentive that, and they hit on this at their news conference. The incentive is that it's remarkably stable, and that you don't have to you get paid by the government. You don't have to worry about your tenant coming up with rent. And there is some truth to that. But like I mentioned, if they are proposing cuts to these programs, then you have to question the long-term sustainability of it. But in the near term, at least, it's reliable. And you know, look, it's one piece of the solution. It's not going to be a silver bullet.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking also about there's the one part of this, getting someone housed initially and then keeping them housed after they get in there.
And that goes to the transitional piece that Matt was referring to. I mean, it's a process to get somebody in, you know, kind of back on their feet. And, you know, we've got such a shortage of affordable housing all across the valley. And so, you know, it is one step. And not the end goal is I think the Lieutenant Governor made clear.
Yeah, Matt Canham, these new homeless resource centers are coming online starting this summer. Is that correct?
That's correct. We heard this week that one of them will be named for Gail Miller, and they did this news conference in front of the building still under construction as they were putting the windows in. So they are making significant headway. We expect it to open up this summer, and then they'll transition the Road Home downtown, as you said, sometime in September, I believe.
Is there? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I think the real test to the whole plan that they've got that they're putting together is going to be when we hit the winter months later, because you know during the summer and spring, the homeless, the needs are less dire, I guess, and so once we hit the winter months is when we're going to really see the surge in people looking for short-term shelter, and that's when we're going to see if they've covered all the bases.
This is a nuanced question or a sort of difficult question to answer, I think. But the general transition or change in sort of policy or procedures for getting people housed or getting them through these homeless resource centers, because part of the project, part of having these homeless resource centers, these new smaller shelters, is to change the strategy for tackling homelessness. Right. At the same time, what does that actually mean? I mean, is it a different process for having people come through and get paired with case managers, for example?
Yeah, the idea roughly is to treat each one of these people as an individual, which means you understand what their needs are, their situation is. Homelessness is a complex problem, and not every person who's homeless is there for the same reason or needs the same thing to help them get out of homelessness. So the idea would be that these individual shelters would track these people, get them the food they need, the medical care they might need, help them with what kind of job skill or training that they might need, and then guide them out of homelessness one by one. That's, you know, that does happen to a certain degree now, but when you have 1,100 beds, you know, you don't have enough people to track each individual. When you have 200 people who can stay at one center, it's a more manageable group.
Okay, so it's maybe more acute sort of care in the instance. So go ahead, Robert.
One quick point. I mean, I think this is all well and good, and I think it's necessary and important. But I think we also need to note that the Utah legislature was asked for $24 million for affordable housing this past session and they gave zero. And so, again, If it's transitional, it's got to be transitioning into something. And if they're not going to put the money in to create that next step, then it's a program that might not work. Mm.
Just quickly before we head to a break, something that you mentioned, Matt, was the naming of this new resource center after Gail Miller. What was that the result of? Was that a gift that she made? Was it a recognition of her work? What can you explain that?
Yes. Gail Miller has been involved in this issue for quite a while now, in some of the planning around how to, you know, move forward on these shelters. So it's not like she just gave money. But the Miller family did promise to match up to $10 million in donations for these resource centers. At this time, I believe that the nonprofit has received $4.6 million of that match. So right now, if you donated to Shelter the Homeless, it would be matched by the Larry H. and Gail Miller Family Foundation.
Okay. That's Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, and thank you for your reporting on this, Matt. It's time for another break in the show. There is still more ahead. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Miller, senior managing editor Matt Canham, and columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Jessica Miller, let's now turn to a profile you wrote of a man who came forward publicly this week to tell his tale of having been molested when he was a child, and his abuser was someone with a fair amount of clout in certain circles here in Utah. He was a filmmaker and one of the founders of a famous film festival. There's a lot of threads to this story. Maybe we can start with how this abuse, this molestation, initially came to light.
Okay, so this initially came to light in February. A man, his name is Sean Escobar, he released a recording to the Truth and Transparency Foundation, which is the nonprofit group behind the Mormon Leaks website. And in this recording, he confronts Sterling Van Wagenen, who is this prominent LDS filmmaker, and asks him, or, you know, confronts him about a 1993 incident where he was sleeping over at Sterling's home, and he and Sterling molested him. And in the recording, Van Wagenen admits that that's what he did, and you know, it's a longer conversation than that. But Sean released that recording in February to the Truth and Transparency Foundation. It kind of became this widespread thing. Everyone was reporting on it. And kind of as a result of that being made public, a little girl ended up going to the police and saying that Sterling had also sexually abused her as well more recently, more like 2013 or 2015. And so Van Wagenen was charged with sexual abuse of that girl recently.
Just going back to the tape for a second, and I want to come back to those charges, but when that was initially released, we didn't know who had recorded it. We didn't know that it was Escobar.
Yeah. So Sean, when he initially released this recording, he wanted to be identified by a pseudonym, which is, we do that pretty typically with sexual assault victims. And so, like, I talked to him. We talked about this when the recording came out, and he kind of told me, you know, about what happened and why he wanted to release it and things like that. But he really was wary of going public with his identity. He was worried about his children and you know, things like that. And then after this little girl came forward, he kind of decided to that this kind of gave him the strength to say, you know, this is me. This is, you know, tying it to him personally and his identification.
He told you about that experience of finding out that there was at least one other person who was sexually abused by Van Wagenen, and it was an emotional moment for him that he felt like it was justified. It was worth it that he had come forward. He'd actually had initial doubts about coming forward at all in the beginning, right?
Yeah, and when he first was talking with me about this, he said, you know, one of the reasons why he wanted to release this recording was that he was concerned that there could be other victims, and so he kind of wanted this to be made public. And then, you know, right after it was made public, there was quite the fallout for Van Wagenen. He lost his job at the University of Utah. The local film society cut ties with him. And so Sean was just watching all of this, and he was like, oh my gosh, like, what have I done? He was like literally like sick with, you know, kind of like self-doubt. Like, what was the purpose of this? Why did I just ruin some guy's life when, you know, maybe I was the only one? And so once this little girl came forward, that kind of was validating to him that he felt like, he felt pushed to do it for some reason, and then once it became known that there were other victims, he kind of felt like that was, like, maybe not validating is the right word, but he knew that there was a reason that he wanted to do it, to release that tape.
On the charges that have been filed against Van Wagenen, has he entered a plea?
He did. It was actually kind of a surprise. I mean, it wasn't a surprise to him or his attorneys, but usually you don't go into your initial appearance in court and plead guilty, and that's exactly what he did. And so it was a little bit of a surprise. It sounded like it was a plea deal that was kind of in the works before the charges were even filed. So he pleaded guilty earlier this week to a charge in American Fork, and then he pleaded guilty, I think yesterday, to a charge in Salt Lake County. So there was two charges, but they both involved the same girl.
Okay. For Sean Escobar, are there charges that could be filed? It's 1993, you said, was when this happened?
Yeah, so that abuse actually was reported to police initially. I think they went to like their local church leaders, and they told Sterling that he needed to go to the police. So he actually went in himself and self-reported in 93. But then the police report says that when the officer called Sean's father, he said that his son, who was 13 at the time, didn't want to talk about it. And so the police officer just closed the case, saying the victim didn't want to cooperate. And so there was a police report at that time, but the case never went to prosecutors because the officer just never really investigated it.
We talked a little bit about who Van Wagenen is. One of the founders of the Sundance Film Festival. Can you talk about his history and who else he is as a filmmaker, sort of circles he ran in, if that makes sense?
Yeah.
Maybe I can help with this.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
Sterling Van Wagenen, he created a film festival that was not called the Sundance Film Festival, but morphed into that over time. He actually is related to Robert Red, Redford through marriage. And so he was prominent there. Most recently, he's made some films for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and their temple processes. So he was actively working in recent years. He's been a producer on some movies through LDS Church ties. So he is a person who was not only prominent in the film community, but still actively involved.
Just turning back to the experience of both this girl and now, of course, of Sean Escobar, I want to bring Robert Gierke, a columnist, in on the conversation. And I'm trying to, you know, I don't know, it's sort of, it. Jessica talked about it being validating, seeing you know, another victim out there. And this is kind of the experience that anyone who comes forward having experienced sexual abuse or molestation as a child, when they come forward, not that they want to see that there are other victims out there, but the fact that, you know, that they made a difference.
I think for anybody who comes forward, it's daunting and intimidating, and I think especially when you're accusing somebody who's important, as Matt mentioned, he has a long pedigree both in the community and in the church and in the arts community that they were living in. And so I think, you know, it does take a tremendous amount of courage. But we've seen it over and over again that oftentimes it just takes the first person to come forward and then others start to come. Mm-hmm. And so I think for the young man who came forward, it's got to be, I don't know, gratifying, I guess, to know that had everybody kept their mouth shut, it could have gone on forever and stayed covered up forever, and there wouldn't have been the accountability, the justice on the back end, and also sort of the closure and the healing that I think is important. So I think it takes a tremendous amount of courage, like I said, but also I think it's tremendously important, and I think from what we've seen, at least there were you know, there was support there for these people once they spoke out.
Jessica Miller, just to close out this topic, on the justice front, you know, what is Sterling Van Wagenen facing in terms of jail time as a result of this? Again, it's two counts, but the same victim.
Right.
What's going to happen?
So the plea deal, the agreement that was made was that he would serve concurrent sentences, so sentences that run at the same time for both of the charges. The charge, I believe, carries a 6-to-life prison sentence. Utah has indeterminate sentencing structures, so he'll kind of get that sentencing range when he's sentenced in July, but it will ultimately be up to the parole board to decide how long he'll spend behind bars.
Okay. Jessica Miller, justice reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks for filling us in on this topic. I wanted to squeeze in one more story before we head to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And this is a story about an audit and what it found related to how different police agencies, different law enforcement agencies around the state of Utah were handling evidence. And Matt Canham, this was kind of an eye-opener, a wake-up call of an audit. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, the state auditor looked through 7 different law enforcement agencies. They were not identified in the reports. We don't know which law enforcement agencies this were, but all of them either lost or misplaced evidence, destroyed evidence, but didn't take it off of their and didn't take it out of their system. This is, you know, these are the people who make sure that these court cases can go forward, that we have confidence that what came from a crime scene actually makes it into courtroom as the right evidence. And finding repeated problems, what they said in this audit is that inaccurate inventory records not only erode public trust, but also may diminish the ability to prosecute past, current, or future cases. And what they found was that I'm trying to get to the number here. They found that 171 items were destroyed but still shown on the inventory as being there. The 139 items during this year and a half they looked were missing. Of those 139 items, 135 of them were drugs or drug paraphernalia, which brings up the possibility that someone could be taking these. Not just misplacing them, but actually actively stealing them, which we saw in a separate case in Weber County, where the evidence room technician was found guilty of eating methamphetamine from evidence bags. This was not – they didn't – the auditor said – sorry. The auditor said this is not what sparked this review, but clearly is a sign of what could happen.
Yeah, missing evidence. I mean, the auditor, John Dougal, said that it's a call to action for agencies around the state. There was also missing money. This is another thing.
There was some missing money. There was one gun that disappeared as well. The Orem police chief, Gary Giles, he told Fox 13 that he thought this was a good thing, that this was a wake-up call, as you said, for agencies that they need to keep a policy in place and they need to follow through. This is a very basic part of policing. But it has huge ramifications.
What do agencies, what are they going to do, law enforcement agencies? Are they charged with doing anything after the audit, or is it just sort of, here's this information, try and do your best with it?
Well, essentially, people aren't following through on the basics. You know, there's a electronic log of what the evidence is. Only certain people should have access to that, because if other people get it, then they can go and take things. So they need to rein in who has access to the actual manifest itself. When they are told to destroy property, such as drugs, there are five steps they're supposed to follow. Only one of the seven departments they looked at actually followed those steps, which includes having a witness sign off on that this actually happened. So it's not just one person acting by his or herself. So there are some very basics. The one nice thing is we've been cataloging evidence as long as we've had law enforcement. And so there's lots of examples of this going right. It is a little concerning that in the seven agencies they looked at, all seven had problems.
Wow. Robert Gerke, you are a columnist, and it's your right to opine. Yeah. What do you say about missing evidence?
Well, I mean, I think it's bad. I think ultimately it's not a new thing, right? This has been a recurring theme in police departments across the country for decades. And so but it's good that we got a review now and that there's some clear steps that laid out that they can take. It's going to take training and resources. Probably more money is going to be needed, because a lot of these departments end up running this on a shoestring budget. And so they're going to need a little bit more money, and they're going to need to be checked again. And I think it's good that the auditor did this. I don't know that he can check all of the departments around the state, but there needs to be some oversight. Matt kind of touched on this. It's bad to lose the stuff from the standpoint of this stuff needs to be taken care of, but in terms of the justice process, this is oftentimes important to that process as well. And so we need to make sure that there's adequate oversight so the process can run its course.
Well, and adequate funding, too, you brought up as well, which is an interesting point. We have got to turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week, because we are running low on time. And Robert Gerke, since we're talking to you, do you want to kick things off?
Sure. A feel-good story. It's obviously, we talked a little bit earlier about graduation week at our colleges around the state. Courtney Tanner has a story that just popped up today, profiling five graduates from the different colleges, a Utah State football player who is graduating despite having lost his mother during the course of his time in college. There's a University of Utah graduate, a widow who lost her husband, and it motivated her to go back to school and study cancer. And also probably an opportunity, it's also, these commencements are also an opportunity to note that Lauren McCleskey would have been graduating this week from the University of Utah, and I think there was a memorial for her at the commencement.
A student who was killed earlier this year. I'm losing the dates, but that is a great underplayed pick from Robert Gerke. Jessica Miller, your pick for underplayed story.
So I'm going to pick a story that I did that ran on Sunday. I did a deep dive into the prison or the jail phone industry, and I found that the call rates, how much people are paying to talk to their loved ones, fluctuates wildly just depending on what county they happen to be in. Someone might pay like $1.50 for a phone call in Weber County than Millard County would cost $12. And it basically came down to contracts and who kind of has the power to negotiate contracts with the same phone company, basically. And, wow. You know, I heard from a lot of people who it's really cost prohibitive for them to keep in touch with their loved ones as they're kind of going through this experience as they're incarcerated, and they want to keep in touch with their loved ones and show them that support.
But it's too expensive in some instances. Yep. Check that out at sltrip.com. Matt Canham, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
The Attorney General, Robert Barr, testified this week in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. It was a contentious conversation. Afterward, the chairman, Lindsey Graham, says that the whole matter of the Mueller investigation into Russia tampering with our election is over. We're going to move forward. And then a reporter asked Mitt Romney what he thinks, and Mitt Romney said, "I'd like to hear from Mr. Mueller himself."
Wow.
So breaking ranks with quite a few other Republicans, Mitt Romney is encouraging the special counsel to testify before Congress. That opportunity could happen as soon as mid-May. Romney has repeatedly been one step more critical than the rest of his colleagues. But this is the first time he's actually expressed an action that would involve oversight. Before, he just said he was sickened by the report. Now he's saying he actually wants to hear from the man, which is pushing this one step forward. Lindsey Graham says doing so would be doing the work of Democratic presidential candidates to beat up Trump, but we'll see what happens.
Go ahead, Robert.
Well, just real quick, I mean, I think it makes perfect sense to hear from him, because this whole Bill Barr committee hearing was revolved around Barr's interpretation of the Mueller report and this letter from Mueller saying that he objected to some of the way it was characterized. So I think it makes sense to have Congress hear from him.
To hear from the man himself. All right, so I'm going to forego my underplayed pick, but really interesting choice there for Matt Canham, and stay tuned to see what happens there. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Thanks very much. We've got Robert Gierke, Jessica Miller, and Matt Canham all in studio with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks to our operations director, Jesse Ellis, and news intern Sarah Sadie Khan for their help. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.